Welcome to Sharp Waves, a podcast from the International League Against Epilepsy. Our episodes cover epilepsy research, clinical care, career development, and issues in diagnosis and treatment from around the globe.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Career Development Series of the Sharp Waves podcast. I'm Alina from the ILE's Young Epilepsy Section, and today I am absolutely thrilled to interview Dr. Maryam Bensalem-Owen.
Yes, good afternoon, Dr. Ivanyuk. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak on the International League Against Epilepsy Sharp Waves podcast. I'm really honored and touched by your invitation. So again, I'm Maryam Bensalem-Owen. I am a neurologist specialized in clinical neurophysiology and epilepsy. And I practice at the University of Kentucky, where I direct the epilepsy program and the epilepsy fellowship program, training program as well. So my father is Algerian and my mother is Bulgarian. I was born in Algiers and I grew up partly in Algeria and partly in Italy. And to complicate a bit things, I went to the French school in Milan. And basically, I joined medical school. For me, it was kind of a calling. After I graduated from high school, I went directly to medical school in Algiers, North Africa. Our medical system is very different than where I currently practice, which is in the United States, since there is no college system in Algeria, like several other countries. I think we see that in other countries. We do 8 years of medical school, and I was the first one in my close and extended family to end up graduating from medical school. So my parents are both engineers, retired engineers, and so we have lots of engineers and lawyers and teachers, but I was the first doctor in my family. But I inspired a cousin to become a doctor too, so that's great. So what really motivated me to go into medical school is really to help. I saw several close relatives suffer from acute or chronic illness, but also myself as a little patient. I was a little patient, and actually for 11 years, I wore a back brace for scoliosis. And so I was kind of exposed to the medical field in that way. Now, so basically early on in high school, I already knew that I wanted to be a doctor. And when I went to medical school, I went with the goal to join Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders. It didn't go as planned, so I never joined Doctors Without Borders, because life is full of twists and turns and surprises, of course.
The years of your medical studies fell onto the time of the Black Decade in Algeria. There was war. How did it impact you personally, and how did it change your professional perspectives?
It did have an impact on me. So for the ones who may not know what the Black Decade refers to or stands for, it's a decade civil war in Algeria that ended in 2002. So it was a difficult time for me to be in medical school. We had returned from Italy. And so I finished my two last years of high school in the French school in Algiers. And actually during that time, just before the war was officially declared, the school a year before was closed. So I think politically they already knew that something was boiling, was preparing. So medical school was exciting, but very stressful in a way. And I think I realized that once I left Algiers or Algeria to pursue my training. Once you live there, you just go with the flow. You don't realize how much stress, and you always have to look at your back and be careful. We had military and police checkpoints and curfews, so really had to be careful, you know, going out at certain times and returning back home or staying in the hospital just to be safe. So I did learn to work in difficult conditions. And so my heart really goes to everyone living in war zones or in a wartime environment. This also helped me connect emotionally with my fellow students and professors. We sadly had one of our professors who was murdered during this time. Everyone considered an intellectual, some people considered intellectual, were actually potential targets. And I did face several situations throughout training in medical school that were mentally taxing. And on a few occasions, I faced personal life-threatening situations, just because sometimes you end up in the wrong place at the wrong time. And once it was in the street, and once was actually when I was doing my rotation in orthopedics. And so we had armed people coming and shooting, and it was very, very scary. When I speak about it now, it feels so surreal. Of course, you know, this was many years ago, and of course, I could have, you know, I'm thinking, you know, I could have burned out or just left medical school from that, but I think it really helped me grow. And also, I suppose it was because I was younger. I think we have a different outlook on life back then.
Thank you so much for reflecting on this time. I suppose, though I know that it was hard, although, as you mentioned, you can only appreciate that if you look back in retrospective, and while you are going through it, you just go with the flow. So returning back to your career pathway, after you finished your medical studies, what drew you to pursue neurology, and how did you decide where to pursue the future training?
After my medical school, I think I felt that I needed to do my training abroad. And again, it was taxing. And so I just was ready for something different. It was 8 years of living in a difficult environment. So I came to the United States for my neurology training. This was really not planned initially, but it happened. And so as a foreign medical graduate, relocating to the United States and starting internship and neurology residency brought a different set of challenges, you know, from the ones I had in medical school. I came alone here. I had no family and no close friends in the States. I had met my future chair, Dr. Joe Berger, and he's like, Maryam, you have to apply to my program. And it was at the University of Kentucky. And I have to admit, I'm very embarrassed to say that I didn't even know where Kentucky was then. But him and his family were so welcoming and supportive, and he considered himself as my American father. and so I had to train and practice when I came here. The challenges are that I had to train and practice not only in a different system, but in a different language. And so for me, it was like a total adventure, Kentucky and all in English. And so it was a big adjustment, but it was fun. It was very interesting. I have fantastic memories of my residency, and the same thing, the bonds and the friendships I made. Very, very special time. But yeah, so I had along the way, I had several mentors and sponsors. It's what I would like to say is that some of these mentors and sponsors were not always in my field. One colleague and mentor that was redefining for me was Dr. Brenda Fahey. She's an anesthesiologist. We did fantastic projects with her and publications regarding EEG education. And she wanted to broaden this for EEG interpretation to non-neurologists. Also I mentioned about my prior chair, Dr. Joe Berger, but also my current chair, Dr. Larry Goldstein, who has been very supportive. And I also found support and mentorship and sponsorship from colleagues with my involvement in professional organizations outside of my institution. And these are, I mean, there are numerous, as Dr. Jonathan Edwards, Dr. Gloria Galloway, Dr. Atif Hussein, Dr. Frank Drislin, but also had several role models, such as Dr. Suzette LaRoche and Dr. Sue Herman. So I'm just very grateful for these colleagues and my colleagues in general, and for all these friendships that we end up professionally nurturing.
Great that so many people around you help you along your way, and you were able to find so many support from your mentors. That's wonderful. When and why did you decide to enter the epileptology field?
Well, during my residency in neurology, I found the brain captivating. Of course, you know, neurology is not just about the brain, but I was just attracted by the brain. And then I found epileptology to be a very dynamic field, which offers a multidisciplinary approach in terms of investigation and management. And during my training as a resident, I was just intrigued by the variety of symptomatology, by the seizure semiology that is produced by a stimulated brain. And one of my mentors during residency, Dr. Tufik Fakhouri, was really a key point in me choosing epilepsy. Now, as much as I find the brain captivating, I find epilepsy cruel, very cruel. It's a frequent neurologic condition with intermittent crisis, as you know, that can dramatically disrupt patients' lives. Seizures, even if they're brief, can have devastating effects on patients and their loved ones. And seizures can cause injuries, death. And epileptology offers this incredible opportunity to really help these patients and their loved ones. So that's why I choose epileptology.
Registration is now open for the 15th European Epilepsy Congress, held September 7th through 11th in Rome, Italy. Join your colleagues for 5 days of teaching courses, platform sessions, symposia, career development sessions, and more. To receive a discount on registration fees, register by May 10th. Visit the ILAE website for more information or register directly at bit.ly/ILAE Rome. That's bit.ly/ILAE Rome. All lowercase. Thanks for listening.
You have so many professional responsibilities, and you are also a single parent. What has that experience been like? Do you have any advice for other physicians who are in the same situation as you?
I had my child during my clinical neurophysiology epilepsy fellowship. So in January, in the middle of the fellowship. And at that time, I was still married, but my ex-husband and I lived in different states. He was finishing his neurosurgery residency, and then he did a pediatric neurosurgical fellowship eventually. We were apart for some time during his training, my training. So our child stayed with me. But then eventually I became officially a single mother, but this was as a faculty, so not as a trainee. Officially, not as a trainee. I did have my child by myself. During fellowship, my mother was able, she had retired, and she was able to come and help me. And so I was very fortunate with that for the last few months so I could finish my fellowship. So yeah, it was not easy. And I'm a part of a small category of people, full-time working physicians who are single parents. And I'm the only one actually in my department in this category, which makes me kind of an outlier. But yes, how would I advise single parents? I would say that it can be done. Is it going to be easy? No. Some days will be extremely difficult, but each day has an end. That's what I think. At the end of the day, the day will end. And what cannot be done in a day or today, it can be completed in the following days. Okay. So sometimes we have this idea that we need to accomplish everything, or everything on the to-do list, and have all these things. And sometimes it's just not a realistic option. You have to kind of take one day at a time, and what is accomplished, you accomplished. Be grateful and move to the next day. Leave a little bit for the next day. That's how I see it nowadays. And also there is always a solution. Sometimes we feel very helpless. We feel overwhelmed, but there is always a solution. May not be what we initially had in mind and intended, but there is always a solution at the end of the day. And also, I would advise single parents or parents in general or anybody struggling to ask for help. Don't be afraid to ask for assistance. It took me some time to understand this, maybe a little bit of pride. And I was in a particular situation as a foreign medical graduate. And then imagine being a single parent, divorced. I mean, it puts you in all this like a very particular category. And for me, I didn't want people to perceive this as a weakness or a way. So a lot of things I kept for myself. And I'm really happy to see the new generation. People are more transparent and are okay to be vulnerable and ask for help. I think this is fantastic. And remember to be kind to yourself, because sometimes we have all these expectations, especially us in the medical field. You know, just to choose this field, we have a certain personality and we don't accept failure, and things don't go the way sometimes we want it to go. We are hard on ourselves. So I think, you know, we need to remember to be kind to ourselves.
The part of your professional activity that I find really fascinating is that you are running the epilepsy fellowship program. Please share the details. How do you run it, and what can make a successful launch for an epilepsy fellowship program?
You know, so it's a new program, and that's challenging by itself. And the program has expanded. So initially, we were a couple of epileptologists, and eventually we became 4, 5, and 8, and now we're 10. Of course, not everybody is with the program 100% of the time, but everybody's involved. And so we had a large volume of patients and a lot of opportunity to teach and educate. And so I had this vision of, you know, creating this fellowship, an ACGME fellowship, accredited fellowship. And for that, of course, I I needed support, and I had the support of my chair, Dr. Larry Goldstein, and my colleagues. Initially, when we submitted, it was just for one position. So now I'm submitting to get a second position. Now we're facing different challenges because it's a new program. Even though it's the only one in Kentucky, it's a new program. So we have competition from bigger programs and more established programs. And so now it's about keeping the fellowship running and filling in the slots, which this is the challenge now. But I think it's a bit challenging in other institutions because of the pool of interested candidates in clinical neurophysiology or epilepsy in general. Just there is a decreased pool compared to other subspecialties.
Why do you think it's like that?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I think right now it used to be. I mean, we used to have more than half our residents, for instance, who wanted to do an epilepsy fellowship, either epilepsy or clinical neurophysiology with emphasis on epilepsy. And things have turned. Now it's more other subspecialties such as vascular, stroke, neurology, hospitalists. We see a lot of people interested, residents in being hospitalist or interventional neurologist, movement disorder. So there is kind of a decrease. And for the United States, I think because of the cuts, the reimbursement, I think that made it a little bit more difficult for people. I think the new generation is very wise, very practical. Those are long hours. We have a very different workflow than other subspecialties. I mean, we look at hours and hours of monitoring. And so really it's a fascinating field, but it's a very different workflow than other subspecialties. And I don't think a lot of people understand the work we do.
I know that you are involved in some interesting activities besides your professional ones. You are involved in some martial arts, and also you dance tango.
I have to thank my son for the martial arts. So this is an activity that I shared with my son for several years. And he probably started when he was like 4 or 5 years old, very young. And actually, I had chosen this activity for him. He was very reserved. And I felt that maybe martial arts will instill a bit of confidence in him. And he joined a class and it didn't go well. And then he insisted that I do it with him. So then we ended up doing it together, which worked out perfectly well because we had this precious time together. And we had the most amazing memories training together and doing competitions together. I just fell in love with martial arts and the way it made me feel. It helps me reset mentally and recharge. Then I did some after Krav Maga, 2.5 years of Krav Maga, then ended up doing capoeira, which I found beautiful. But now I'm doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and I think this is it. This is it. I found it. I'm in love with Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and I can't say enough. And I feel that Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is such a intellectually, it's very physical, but intellectual is very stimulating. The learning process, the combinations, you know, if I have to compare it to something, it could be like maybe, and it's frequently compared to chess, playing chess, but physically, you know, playing chess physically, because you end up in these very different positions and you have to find a solution, how to get out of it or how to not be submitted. I also think about jiu-jitsu as a language. Is basically you learn all these little blocks, you put them together, you make sentences and then you make paragraphs and then you learn this language. So for me, it's really like a language. And so intellectually, I find it very, very stimulating. I learned a lot from my grandmaster in Taekwondo. He asked me, and this is a question he not just asked me, but other people. He will ask, what is the most important thing in your life? And I would say, of course, I was with my son. I was like, my son is the most important thing in my life. And he will reply, that's the wrong answer. Until one day he told me, the most important thing in your life should be you. Because if you're not well physically and mentally, if you don't take care of yourself, how can you take care of your family and the people who rely on you? I still struggle with this concept, but it makes sense. So that's why I think we have to take care of ourselves so we can take care of others.
That's really inspiring. Thank you.
Okay.
But what about the dances? That's something really different from martial arts, something more considered to be more elegant, I would say. How did you get involved into that field as well? And how do you combine those?
When I was in residency, I did take some classes for ballroom dancing, and I really enjoyed that. And but then, you know, I got busy with residency, of course, could not do everything. And so basically, my brother's significant other, at the age of 37 years old, she died from leukemia. But before she died, it was she had a few days to live and then ended up few weeks. But I really wanted to honor her because that was such a tragedy for us and for my brother, for her family. And I was kept thinking, you know, can you imagine you're 37 years old and you're told like you have a few weeks to live or a few days to live, what would you do? Because we really take life for granted and life just passes. And we get sometimes worried about little trivial things where we forget the bigger picture, I feel. And so basically I ran across a studio that was offering lessons, a couple of free lessons just as a trial. And so kind of I ended up joining the studio, but I really wanted to focus on Argentine tango. So, but I did that for her to honor her because I was like, we really take life for granted. And this is so, so wrong. I mean, I tried lots of dances, but my favorite of all is Argentine tango. It just, tango just sweeps you up. That's how I feel about it. And the same as the similarities with Brazilian jiu-jitsu, it's really you grow and you improve. You should not be comparing yourselves to others. Same when I go on the mats and do training with Brazilian jiu-jitsu with my drilling partners and when we roll, the comparison should not be about how am I better than this one or that one? Are they better than me? It should be a comparison with yourself. You can't be good doing jiu-jitsu a couple of years. It takes decades to improve. There is so much. The combinations are amazing. So much to learn. And the same thing for Argentine tango. It takes years to find what they call the axis and that connection with your partner when you dance. And so basically, it's a never-ending task of refining the technique. And so it takes years to advance. And so I like the challenge.
Thank you so much for sharing those experiences with us. You have accomplished so much, both professionally and personally. I just wonder, how do you find time for all of that?
Well, I feel that right now, I feel that I'm behind with my life, as I say, not just behind with a lot of things. I mean, it is difficult to manage all, okay? But if I don't make the time, then I'm not going to do it. Because if you think about it, work frequently goes beyond the daily. I mean, I don't, you know, for residency, but especially in academia, it's very tricky because a lot of the work that we do is service. There is documentation. There is so much that we do, even in private practice, of course, but the service that we do, I mean, there are colleagues who are in private practice who do service, who are involved with organizations or committee work in their institutions or hospitals. But all this is extra work and it takes time to complete, in addition to being a doctor, in addition to caring for patients. But then you realize if you don't set these boundaries, work will just continue to erode into your personal life. I mean, it does. It does after hours. I mean, we're doing emails, you know, we're writing articles for some, you know, the ones who write articles and love to do that. It just takes a lot and it takes on your personal time. And the solution is not to hope for 48-hour days. The solution is to keep the 24-hour day, but to be able to manage and kind of find a little bit of space, even if it's a short time. I mean, for instance, you know, for Taekwondo, sometimes I can't do the full hour. On the weekend, sometimes if I'm on call, I show up for 15 minutes. But I'll say at least these 15 minutes were for me. Life, you know, becomes busy and we make so many sacrifices that we forget to take care of ourselves. I think that we need to reconnect with who we are and what we like and what makes us happy or even explore new things. And life happens. And we have to keep that in mind. And we see it every day with our patients and their families. But when it hits your own family, then you see things a bit maybe with a different perspective. So really setting boundaries. Another thing is, and this is something I had to learn and it takes time to learn, is also, you know, to note, to say no. If you set your time to spend with your family or friends and this is your time, you have to say no, you know, be grateful. If you're offered another opportunity, say thank you. But also if that decision was to spend that time differently, you have to respect it for yourself and others, you know, the people that you love. My next step is to work on my sleep schedule. So I don't sleep much, of course, because again, you can't expend time. So something has to give up. But this is my little weakness, and I don't get enough sleep, and I need to work on that.
I think many of our listeners, including myself, can relate to this. And yeah. This is an advice to everybody. Please take care of your sleep. Sleep is important. And especially yes. for you as neurologists, it should be crystal clear that we all need to sleep enough.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. What would you like to accomplish as you move along? What are your next things in your to-do list? What would you like to accomplish from the professional standpoint?
As an epileptologist, what I found disheartening is the patients who live with epilepsy that are being referred to epilepsy centers or to epileptologists or more than 20 years after their epilepsy has started. And I think this is disheartening. I mean, those are statistics or numbers that I heard when I was a resident. It was more than 20 years ago. And we still see that. Not too long ago, I saw in my clinic somebody who had epilepsy, 34 years diagnosed, and he's only now referred to an epilepsy center. So what I'd like to do, and this is an idea I had for a long time, we started doing it with one of my colleagues, Dr. Sid Kapoor, and we really build a network for us in the state of Kentucky, where we can have patients, we can have patient navigators, the Epilepsy Foundation of Kentuckiana, which is an affiliate of the Epilepsy Foundation National. Other epilepsy centers, NAC centers, level 3 and level 4 centers, come together and work together and be able to refer patients. And because there is a lot of competition, I think, between centers. And I think it shouldn't happen that way, because at the end of the day, it's not about us. It's about the patients. And so, yeah, it's all about, again, connecting people so we can all work together well and to serve our patients well and help them.
Thank you so much for your commitment, and thank you so much for sharing all of your insight with us today, all your career pathway. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Dr. Ivanyuk, thank you so much for, again, giving me the opportunity to speak with you, and thanks for the work you do, and I'm really looking forward for the new generation of neurologists, epileptologists such as yourself taking over and doing amazing, fantastic things.
Thanks for listening to Sharp Waves. Our content is meant for informational purposes only and not as medical or clinical advice. The International League Against Epilepsy is the world's preeminent association of health professionals and scientists working toward a world where no person's life is limited by epilepsy. Find more Sharp Waves episodes wherever you get your podcasts or at ilae.org.